If I were to ask, or more appropriately, somebody else were to ask you, because I should know the answers also, but if somebody else were to ask you what you or your church believe, you and this group could probably give dozens and dozens of answers to that question. We all know and we share beliefs that are common. The Bible is the inspired word of God. And again, this just, you know, God the Father is who eternally existed. We have a Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ, who is the Son of the Father. We know that the church is the spiritual body and the great human potential for all of mankind. We could go on and on and on and on. Now, likely we would word these beliefs slightly different, but what we would be doing is articulating our common beliefs. We would be articulating our common doctrines. Doctrine is basically or just simply a principle or position or body of principles in a branch of knowledge or a system of belief. And again, we all could do this. But far from being a boring list of beliefs, doctrines form the foundational principles and beliefs that inform and support a much broader set of teachings and understandings. Again, they're sort of the core elements in that foundation whereby other things are built upon. And they inform messages, they inform our prayers, they inform how we interact with everybody else. But again, it's this body of belief that in turn impacts our actions. And it has a significant impact on how we function. And it's simply because no matter who you are as a human, you will act out what you believe. That's true of Christians, that's true of everybody else. But this foundational common belief system and structure brings us a set of unity and a commonality that has to be there for any group to have a unified goal. You know, again, we won't go over it, but just out of, for kicks and giggles, I went to the UCG website. We actually have 39 statements that start with the word "we believe" as our foundational doctrines. And they form our core belief. And again, you can go to many other sites and you will find this. But those are those doctrines, those are those teachings that form and build our unity. Again, we go on and on talking about the different things they will do, but they do foster unity. And they build a common lexicon whereby we can communicate. We talk. Words in those doctrines, those beliefs create meaning. And again, as I mentioned, they inform our thinking. They direct our understanding, our views, and our teachings. Now, I don't know if you've ever considered it or not, but Satan also has his doctrines, and he has his fundamental beliefs. And his doctrines do the same thing. They inform his kingdom, his way of thinking, his understanding, his views, his interactions with each other, his teachings. They do the same thing. Today, I want to explore some of the doctrines of Satan. Again, to be clear, not the doctrine about Satan, but his actual teachings. What is it that he teaches? What is it that he believes? What is it that those who adhere to that understanding and share that lexicon, in turn, act out in life? What does the Bible tell us about that? It is important for us to know what Satan's doctrines are. And it's important fundamentally because we must be consciously aware of them. We have to be aware of them. If we're not, we cannot and we won't actively resist them. And we are called to actively resist them. Just like as a Christian, we are called to adhere to God's doctrines and God's teaching. Now, this can be a little bit of a challenge, I will confess. I actually got this idea by reading an article titled "The Doctrine of Satan." They went on to talk about Satan, the belief of Satan, but I thought, well, Satan's got his own teachings, so let's talk about it. But it can be a little bit of a challenge because, quite frankly, there is not a lot in the Bible. There is not a lot of direct words from Satan. You know, it's like, I actually took the time to do this. There's sort of the direct words, right? There's words that Satan said, and we know this, you know, Eve, you will surely not die, or you shall surely not die, however it's worded. There are words that Satan in the Bible are recorded that he uttered, that he spoke. There's the indirect words, and again, we get this type of interaction from Isaiah where, you know, it says, you know, I will ascend to heaven. Is, you know, basically the writer saying, you said in your heart, I will go do these things. It's not directly a word of Satan, but again, if you add that up, and the direct and the indirect, along with Satan, where he quotes God, which again, would be truth, although we know Satan speaking this again, going back to Eve, he says, you shall, as God not said, you shall not surely eat every tree of the garden. If you add all that up, you don't have a lot, to be honest with you. Anybody want to just throw out a wild guess? How many words, and I did the New King James, every version's going to be a little different. Anybody want to take a guess how many words you would have if you take all three of those, the Satan's direct, his indirect, and where he's quoting God, every word in the Bible. Anybody want to throw out a number? I know Aaron's got a number on his head. No, that's, oh man, you're cutting me low. That's better, okay. All right, 388 words. Way off, man. 388 words. There's 770,000, over 770,000 words in the New King James Version of the Bible. So again, just because I'm I like crunching numbers, that amounts to 5/10,000ths of the Bible. So again, just to give you a sense of what we're working with. With that little bit of information, again, and I would argue appropriately so, the Bible is not there to explain Satan's way of life. It is there to explain God's way, but in contrast to something, we will seek to identify Satan's doctrines through interactions and through some of his surrogates, and just because that's what we have to work with. But before we do that, I want us to just step back a little bit. And I want to point out two things about Satan that we just have to keep in mind as we go through this process or through this conversation. Two things. One, he is fully competent, organized, and purposeful. I think we do ourselves a great disservice when we sometimes step back and we create the, you know, Hollywood and all the, everything, you know, everything from Dante to Hollywood's created images of what Satan is and is not in our minds. And we immediately kind of go to that. Satan is much more competent than some caricature dressed in a red suit with a tail, you know, and laughing weird. He's much more organized, and for our purposes today, he's much more purposeful. A lot of what he does is not just sort of just chaos and confusion. I mean, it results in those, but he's organized in his own way. And that's something we need to remember. It is important that we all remember he is a real person. He has a domain. He has a government. He has constituents. He has laws and rules. He has penalties for breaking his laws and rules. He is intelligent. He is knowledgeable. He has his own will. His own definition of moral character. He has his own emotions. He has his own ability to be an executive and have organization ability. And for our purposes today, he has his own teachings and doctrines. I have scriptures to back up every one of those statements. They're in the Bible. It's a wonderful Bible study. Just go looking at for all the instances where Satan comes up. He's got it all. I mean, in that sense, he's not just, again, some caricature we put on things. So he is highly organized and he is purposeful. So as we go through this, please keep that in the back of your head. The other thing that I think is worth keeping in the back of your head is his work is being done in the same field as God's work. It's an instructive parable that we won't go over in detail, but again, just to bring it to mind, parable of the tares amongst the wheat. We know the parable well. Good seed was sown, right? And while the man slept, an enemy comes and sows tares amongst the wheat. It's not known until the crop starts forming and then servants look at it and they're very similar, but then they start seeing some differences. They look the same, but they're not acting the same. The decision is made to let them grow together until the harvest. The lesson for us today, second lesson we need to keep in mind, is he is the arch counterfeiter. He is the best at the best at the best. And he is now hard at work in the same field that the Lord sowed his good seed in. seeking to crowd out and to slow the growth of the good seed. By a plan that closely resembles the wheat in its appearance, not in its fruit. By a process of imitation, he is trying to neutralize the work of Christ. There's an author, one that, quite frankly, I would not recommend running and going to, reading a lot of his stuff. Every now and then I stumble on some old, you know, this guy died back in 1952, was a preacher in the early 1902, 1910, 12 range. English Bible teacher, actually married a young lady out of Bowling Green, Kentucky, of all places, but spoke in the kind of the west or south, then moved back to England. His name is Arthur Pink. And again, wouldn't necessarily recommend him for a lot of doctrinal, but he has a really good perspective on Satan being the arch counterfeiter. Just want to read a little blurb out of his writings. Arthur Pink says this. He says, the success of an illegitimate coiner depends largely upon how closely the counterfeit resembles the genuine article. A lie is often not so much as the total denial of truth as a perversion of it. That is why half a lie is always more dangerous than a complete repudiation. Hence, when the father of lies enters the pulpit, it is not his custom to flatly deny the fundamental truths of Christianity. Rather, does he tacitly acknowledge them and then proceed to give an erroneous interpretation and false application. For example, he would not be so foolish as to boldly announce his disbelief in a personal God. He takes his existence for granted and then gives a false description of his character. Satan would not be so foolish as to ignore the central figure of human history, the Lord Jesus Christ. On the contrary, his gospel acknowledges him to be the best man that ever lived. Attention is drawn to his deeds of compassion and works of mercy, the beauty of his character and the sublimity of his teaching. His life is eulogized, but his vicarious death is ignored. The all-important atoning work of the cross, Protestant, whatever shape it was, the all-important work of the cross is never mentioned, whilst the triumphant and bodily resurrection from the grave is regarded as one of the credulities of a superstitious age. It is a bloodless gospel and represents a crossless Christ who is received not as God manifest in the flesh, but merely the ideal man. I think that's a pretty good description of exactly what Satan would do. He's not gonna deny history. He's just gonna take it and counterfeit it a little bit and then present it as facts and spread it out amongst people. Again, he is, and his doctrine is, highly organized. He is an intelligent being who establishes his doctrines as slight variations and sweet-sounding alternatives to God's doctrine. And more importantly, again, keep that in the back of your mind, but more importantly, he actively, purposefully, and methodically teaches them. Perhaps more than any other point in human history, it is incumbent upon us to be aware of Satan's doctrines. In fact, the Spirit gives us clear and express warnings. We don't have to turn there. I'll just read it to you. I think you'll recognize this scripture. It's 1 Timothy 4, verses 1 and 2. It says, now the Spirit expressly says, that in the latter times some will depart from the faith, giving heed to deceiving spirits and doctrines of demons. It is a warning to us. He goes on to say, speaking lies and hypocrisy, having their own conscience seared with a hot iron. I like the phrase, lies and hypocrisy. When I read that, I'm like, that's like an enigma wrapped in a riddle, right? I mean, it's this lies, and they have one image, but then they have this hypocritical component to it. And it is a doctrine of demons. And it's, again, it's an express warning to those who are in the latter days and the end of the age. All of this started with the early New Testament church. I do want to turn over to Galatians chapter 1. Just want to read a few verses. Because this early deception kicked off, again, in the early days of the New Testament church. Galatians chapter 1. We'll start in verse 6. He says, I marvel that you are turning away so soon from him who called you in the grace of Christ to a different gospel. Oh, so, you know, again, there was a gospel being preached that was different than what the disciples of Christ had brought. And Paul's already saying to the Galatians, I marvel that you have already taken this path. It was different than the one Christ had delivered. Verse 7, which is not another. Again, think about the wheats and the tares. It's not another, but there are some who trouble you who want to what? Pervert the gospel of Christ. They're not coming up with some great other deity that for you to go follow. They're perverting the one that was given. So closely does the gospel of Satan resemble that which it parodies that the majority of Christianity has been deceived by it. Think about that. It's so good. It has deceived the majority of people that says, I follow Christ. He is my Lord and he is my Savior. And it's deceived them. It's pulled them in directions that were not. It is a perversion of the actual gospel of Christ. And remember, we are expressly warned about this in the latter days. Again, Satan's gospel is founded on this concept of perversion of the gospel of Christ. It is not a system of revolutionary principles, nor yet a program of anarchy. Again, when we hear about that, that's where I think we automatically go. I'd recognize it. And again, as we go through this, I think we'll see that it's very closely related and we can be impacted by it. But again, it's not a system of these radical principles or this sort of, you know, huge upheaval and a revolt and revival type situation. It does not promote strife and war, but rather it aims at peace and unity. It fosters the fraternal spirit whereby the human race is regarded as one great brotherhood. It does not seek to draw down the natural man, but to improve him and uplift him. It advocates education and cultivation and appeals to the best that is within us. It aims to make the world such a comfortable and congenial habitat that Christ's absence from it will not be felt and God will not be needed. It endeavors to occupy man to so much with this world that he has no time or inclination to think of the world to come. It propagates the principles of self-sacrifice, charity, benevolence, and teaches us to live for the good of others and to be kind to all. It appeals strongly to the carnal mind and is popular with the masses because it ignores the solemn fact that the nature of man is a fallen creature, alienated from the life of God and dead in trespasses and sin, and the only hope lies in being born again. Basically, it gives you sweet-sounding, smooth, and comfortable alternatives to the stark contrast drawn by the gospel of God, which is clear darkness and clear light. It'll give you an alternative. It'll give you some shade of gray. For the rest of the message, I want to look at some familiar verses. Again, not about Satan directly, although you can glean a lot of this. Just want to talk about what we can learn about his tactics, his methods, but more importantly, his teachings and his doctrines. And as we go through this, ask ourselves one overarching question. When you listen to what this world teaches you, when you listen to Hollywood media in general, when you hear our politicians, when you hear our lawyers, when you hear our educational institutions, what do you hear? What do you hear? Again, we'll get through as many of these as we can. I only have 7, so this way you'll know if I'm on time. And so far I'm doing really well. Doctrine number 1. Satan believes you should actively reject authority and determine for yourself what is right and what is wrong. Satan believes that. And he teaches people that. Actively reject it. You have a right to decide what is right and what is wrong. I call this the mother of all doctrines. Because once you believe this, you are open to every other one. This has to happen. You have to believe you have the right to self-determination and self-actualization. All of those are taught in psychology classes, and not in a good way. They can present it in a very good way, but it's all about you get to decide. Nobody should ever tell you what you can and cannot do. You can reject all the authority. You can become whatever you want. During the deception of Eve, Satan offers Eve this exact proposition. And I think it's one of the reasons it's God saw fit to make sure the first thing we get in the Bible from Satan is this idea that you can decide. You can reject authority and you can decide for yourself what is right and what is wrong. He said, the day you eat of it, your eyes will be open, for you will be like God, knowing good and evil. Again, you can decide. Choose. We got what? I don't know. I won't tell Matt, but I think we're over a little bit here. Every one of us, if we go off and decide, we're going to have however many we got here, we're going to have that many different teachings and beliefs. Again, God's doctrine unifies us around one commonality. We all seek that. Satan's doctrine is going to do the same thing. But this is one of his, that you can reject authority. You can be just like him. You can almost hear him, you know, Satan's argument, if we put it in modern day terms. You're free to do what you want, as long as it doesn't harm someone else. Anybody here heard that in the last week or something very similar? You're free. You can be, do whatever you want. Just don't hurt somebody. Sounds good. I actually got chastised for about 2 months ago because I was advocating you shouldn't be doing something that just you shouldn't be doing. But it's important that we understand Satan believes as a doctrine. And again, it does all those things we talk about. It informs his teaching, informs his views. It changes, and his adherents believe it, and they propagate it out. Satan believes you should actively reject authority and determine for yourself what is right and what is wrong. I ask you, have you heard this recently? Because what he taught at Eve and Adam, he's still teaching today. It's still a message out there. Doctrine number two. You can achieve your purpose apart from God's plan. He wants you to believe that. Satan teaches that you can achieve your grand human potential devoid of God. Again, do you hear that? Jesus Christ is our own model. He knew who he was. He knew his purpose, obviously greater than any of us. But once we are called, we should know our purpose too. And it is not achievable outside of God's plan. You cannot do it any other way besides God's purpose and his calling in your life and him living in you. Jesus Christ had, in one sense, the benefit, if I can articulate it that way, of knowing that from the foundation of the earth. We know this back in the temptation of Jesus. Again, it's something we're all familiar with. I just pulled out the quotes, what Satan said to Christ. He said, if you are the Son of God, command these stones to become bread. If you are the Son of God, throw yourself down, for it is written, he shall give his angels charge over you, and in their hands they shall bear you up, lest you dash your foot against a stone. Then he takes him up to a high mountain, shows him all the kingdoms of the world. And he says, all these things I will give you if you fall down and worship me. That's the temptation. What happened just prior to this? What was Christ and the whole experience, the thing leading up to this? Does anybody happen to know what occurred significantly right before the temptation?
Christ fasted for
40
days.
Yep.
He fasted.
Yep. Christ fasted right before that. Or before this, one other big thing. So this is the thing that's important because Satan goes right at this one. Christ fasted, yes, to draw close. But he also, the heavens opened, the Father looked down and said, this is my Son in whom I am well pleased. First thing Satan says, if you're the Son, do this. He goes right at the very core of who Christ knew he was. And he's going to come after that very core for us too. He's going to get you to question, So you think you're the Son of God, huh? You think you're pretty cool? And that's what he went after. Then twice he went after that. Then he shows them all the kingdoms. And he said, I'll give it all to you. See, Christ knew his purpose was to be the Son of God, was to be the Savior of all mankind, and will be to rule over all kings, including putting out the devil. Satan's offering it all outside of God's plan. You don't have to do this. You don't have to suffer. You can do all of this. He tried to get him to doubt who he was, and then he offered him the ability to accomplish it all without any pain or any suffering, essentially going outside of God's plan for Christ. And we know, again, I don't think I have it in my notes today, but Christ said, all that the Father has told me to do, I'm doing that, and that's it. Christ knew who he was. Christ recognized this same doctrine, even when it was taught through his friends. He recognized it. We know this, again, for time's sake, I won't read it, but we know the story. Peter's rebuke, for note takers, it's over in Mark chapter 8, verses 31 through 33. Jesus Christ was openly telling everybody what's coming. And yes, you know, there's a crucifixion coming. He's telling them many things. I'm going to be rejected by the elders and the priests and the scribes. I'm going to be killed and I'm going to be risen in 3 days. Peter pulls him aside and privately rebukes him, says, far be it from you, Lord, this shall not happen to you. Again, we know Christ's response. We know his reply. First words that we have recorded, get behind me, Satan. Because this was the plan. This was the purpose. And he could not achieve his purpose outside of God's plan. Satan wants you to believe that. He wants you to believe there is a grand purpose and a grand thing you can become. You can become self-actualized and self-realized and all those nice sounding things outside of God. You can decide to be that. And he'll offer you a path. He'll offer you things to get you there. Contrary to this is the bowing of the knee and the surrender and submission to God, who is the one that will actually truly get you to achieve your purpose and your potential. Brethren, Satan is teaching that you can achieve your purpose and your potential outside of the purpose and the plan God has for you. I ask you again, have you heard that recently? I'll also ask, have you believed it? Do you believe that? Third doctrine I have. Satan teaches that the human potential is not to be a full-born child of God. Piggybacks right off the last one. This is your great potential. And again, think back of the wheat and the tares. His teaching isn't to deny that you can become a child of God. His teaching will deny that you can become a full-born child of God, a full-born son of God. And it seems above all else, he wants to distract you from this. And I agree, in a way, this is completely inconceivable. It is completely unbelievable that this could be, that God could take mere sweaty, gross, stinky humans, although when we shower and comb our hair, we look pretty good, that he could take us, who are the lowest form of sentient beings. I don't know if you've ever thought of it that way. We always think we're pretty grand. For the conscious beings that we know of in the universe, we're the lowest form there is. God can take that and make them a natural born child. One may ask, how can God take dirt and make them humans? But I get why it could sound inconceivable or that can't be. It must mean something else. And Satan will teach. Yes, it means something else. He'll get you to believe in any other future, especially for those who are Christians. He'll get you to believe in any other thing besides true sonship. You can be a super high angel. You could be a super, super hot, dangerous high angel. Anything but the Son of God. In one sense, we have to look no further than the doctrine of the Trinity. The doctrine of the Trinity is bad in so many ways, but the worst thing I think it does, it excludes anybody from entering the God family. you could be really close. You could be right there on the throne. You can do a lot of things. You can sit in heaven. You can see God, but you can't be a child. God's offering you sonship. Satan teaches that's not the case. Turn over, if you would, to 1 John. 1 John chapter 4. 1 John chapter 4, we'll start in verse 1. It says, "Beloved, do not believe every spirit, but test the spirits whether they are of God." Starting out with saying, hey, you got some things that are coming your way. You need to test them. Because many false prophets have gone out into the world. By this, we know the spirit of God. Every spirit that confesses that Jesus Christ has come in the flesh is of God. Now, I read a lot. I know what they all say. Well, anybody that says Jesus Christ confesses and they know and they are from God. The reality is there's no significant disagreement amongst Christians for sure that Christ came in the flesh and walked on this earth. Even amongst non-Christians, they believe he was in the flesh. I mean, they just call him a really super good prophet. But you don't even have to be Christian to believe Christ came in the flesh. Yet he's saying, you can test them by this. You can know whether they are of God. Verse 3, and he said, every spirit that does not confess that Jesus Christ has come in the flesh is not of God. And this is the spirit of Antichrist. Directly coming out of Satan and devil. This is his spirit. This is his doctrine. Which you have heard was coming and is now already in the world. You are of God, little children, and have overcome them, because he who is in you is greater than he who is in the world. And there is the explanation of Christ, or the Christ coming in the flesh. He dwells in you. There are not a lot of churches that teach that. This is what it means to confess that Jesus has come in the flesh. And again, we'll read a little bit more to bolster that thought. Verse 5, he says, they are of the world. Therefore, they speak as the world. And the world hears them. Verse 6. We are of God. Again, contrasting the two. He who knows God hears us. He who is not of God does not hear us. By this we know the spirit of truth and the spirit of error. Again, it is Christ dwelling in you that lets you distinguish the spirit of truth and error. Remember the Trinity, though. That teaching alone, which you are labeled a heretic for, by the way, and you are labeled a non-Christian because you don't believe in the Trinity, is the very thing that prevents you from being a full child of God as a doctrinal belief. John clarifies and makes this even more plain. So let's turn over to 1 John 3, verses 1 through 3. It is Christ coming in the flesh. Christ has come in the flesh. In this room, to people here. He's offering it to others. He's offering, and he said, I will come make my home with you. I will come to you. I mean, we could, literally multiple messages could just be given on that one topic. 1 John chapter 3, verse 1. Behold, what manner of love the Father has bestowed on us, that we should be called children of God. Again, that is a statement that should draw, just cause us to fear and thank God that that can be the case. That we can be called children of God. Therefore, the world does not know us. What did we just read? They won't understand. And it's okay, because Christ just isn't in them yet. You are the first fruits. That's what God's plan is. Because the world, in this case, it did not know him. Beloved, now we are children of God. This is who we are, and it has not yet been revealed what we shall be. But we know that when he is revealed, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. And everyone who has this hope in him purifies himself just as he is pure. We are the children, and this hope is within us, and we will see him, a full-born child of God. Satan says that is not true. And he'll teach you that, and he'll get you even, and I think the way it manifests in the church is that the general idea that it's like, I'm not good enough. You're right. Whoever's thinking that, I think that sometime. You're not, I'm not. But that is what he's offering. Don't diminish it. Don't listen to the doctor that says that can't be. It is. It's true. Our response to this doctrine, I think, is equally important. Turn over real quick to 2 John chapter 1. 2 John chapter 1, we'll start in verse 7. He says, "For many deceivers have gone out into the world who do not confess that Jesus is coming in the flesh." This is a deceiver and an antichrist. This is Satan's gospel. It is his doctrine. He will tell you, yes, you can be sons. Yes, you can be in the family, but not quite that. Again, that little twist away from it. And he offers you something subpar that sounds really good. John says it's an deceiver and an antichrist. Verse 8, "Look to yourselves that you do not lose those things we work for, but that you may receive a full reward. Whoever transgresses and does not abide in the doctrine of Christ does not have God. He who abides in the doctrine of Christ has both the Father and the Son. If anyone comes to you and does not bring this doctrine, do not receive him into your house nor greet him, for he who greets him shares in his evil deeds." We're constantly admonished, don't partake of some of these things because you're sharing with the table of demons in times. And he's essentially making the same argument here. Be nice to him. We get the story here. The point is, we don't begin to believe it. We don't start adhering to that. We don't diminish what God is offering us and take some subpar alternative that Satan says, "Here, this sounds really cool. Do this." But again, Satan is teaching this. Paul calls this dynamic the riches of the glory of this mystery, which is Christ in you, the hope of glory. Colossians 1:27 for anybody who wants to jot it down. Again, brethren, Satan teaches that the human potential is not to be a full-born child of God. He's teaching that. Doctrine number 4. Satan teaches the only reason to serve God is because of what he gives you. Alternatively, you could say Satan teaches that it's God's fault if you're not happy. Why not? Let's blame him. I think this one's real popular today. Blame God for every ill and every calamity. Basically, we want to be able to live the life of openly rejecting God, living whatever we want, going back to the first doctrine of Satan. I could do whatever I want as long as it doesn't hurt somebody else. And then anything that comes bad, I'll just blame God. And it usually comes, and this is one of the things that just red flag for me. The phrase, "a God of love wouldn't," and then you begin to fill in the blanks. A God of love wouldn't let people suffer, wouldn't allow war, wouldn't allow violence, starvation, disease, and on and on and on. Satan teaches you that's God's fault. That's his doctrine. Satan declares his belief in this teaching just by the questions and the assertions he has for one of God's earliest servants. When he says, "Does Job fear God for nothing?" That's the question, because he's declaring his belief. He's only serving you for what you're giving him. Do we hear that today? Later he says, "You have made a hedge around him, about his household, and around all that he has on every side. You have blessed the work of his hand and his possessions and increased the land. But now stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will surely curse you to your face." That's what he believes. And he teaches that, and he is convincing many, many people to be angry at God for what is going on. And it is not God's fault. Even later, he says, "Skin for skin. Yes, all that a man has, he will give for his life. But stretch out your hand now and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will surely curse you to his face." Again, we know Satan's mind. We know his teaching and his doctrine. That's going to be manifest in his system, in his government. I love Job's response. Again, I know we have chapters, but the phrase that I love for it is fairly soon after this. In fact, it's in Job chapter 2, verse 9, I think. He says, shall we indeed accept good from God, and shall we not accept adversity? I don't know that I have the soundness of mind to say that after all that had occurred to Job. But to his credit, God says this, in all this, Job did not sin with his lips. That's a testament right there. That Job didn't flex, he didn't bend. He's like, I know who my God is. Now, God obviously had some things to learn. But Satan was teaching, and God let him act it out, and it impacted Job as a servant. Satan believes you will only serve God for what God will do for you. Do you believe that? Have you bought into that argument? Is that what we do sometime? Do we serve God for what he will do for me? Doctrine number 5. Satan teaches that all you need is faith. Now, whoa, you're getting a little closer, right? I mean, we know we need faith. Because the accusation that immediately comes back is you are trying to earn your salvation. Satan will teach us. Turn over to James. James chapter 2. We'll start in verse 14. He says, what does it profit, my brethren, if someone says that he has faith but does not have works? Can faith save him? It's a good question. If a brother or sister is naked and destitute of daily food, and one of you says to them, depart in peace, be warmed and filled, but you do not give them the things which are needful for the body, what does it profit? Thus also, faith by itself, if it does not have works, is dead. But someone will say, you have faith and I have works. Show me your faith without your works, and I will show you my faith by my works. You believe that there is one God. You do well. Even the demons believe and tremble. That's why I think this is a great doctrine, because the demons have faith in one sense. They believe God. They believe he's coming back to punish them. They believe he's coming back to banish. They know he is. Remember when Christ was here, they said, why are you here? Is it time? They know what's coming. Satan wants you to believe that all you need is faith. And again, you get criticized if you say, no, I actually got to act on that. I should act that out in my life. And that God requires that of me, requires me to do something with it. Knowledge and belief must have a corresponding action. Again, there's a church, the end of Revelation. I think Mr. Petty sounds like he'll cover it in his next sermon. Says, I know your works, and they were judged by what they did, not what they believed. I mean, faith in that sense. Satan wants you to believe that. Satan teaches it. It's an active message that goes out. Doctrine number 5. I think I'm going to get through them all. Satan teaches the misery. What? A 6. You're right. See, sorry, Tim. Good call. I was just keeping you on your toes. Yes, it is doctrine number 6. Satan teaches the misuse of that which is natural and against proper use of the creation. Turn over, if you would, just real quick to 1 Timothy chapter 4. Again, like I mentioned early on, I know we're kind of going through surrogates. We're going through messages. We're saying doctrines of demons, and we're trying to unpack the teaching that goes behind that. But if you think about this one, this is very common these days, teaching what is against nature and against proper use of the creation as God's designed it, given it to us. 1 Timothy, again, chapter 4, we'll start in verse 1. Now the Spirit expressly says in the latter times, some will depart from faith, giving heed to deceiving spirits and doctrines of demons. We quoted this one earlier, but didn't read all the way through. Speaking lies and hypocrisy, having their own conscience seared with a hot iron. Forbidding to marry. Again, this is a doctrine of demons. A teaching. forbidding to marry and commanding to abstain from foods which God created to be received with thanksgiving by those who believe and know the truth. Paul's just giving two examples here to Timothy. Outlawing that which is natural. Forbidding to marry. That's just, I mean, again, that's a natural, God-ordained thing, but forbidding it in some cases. And then again, he goes on and he's just bringing up two examples, but he is distorting the intended use of creation. Forbidding to eat these foods that God actually did create to be eaten. Not everything. God didn't create arsenic to be eaten or whatever. But the things God did create, we eat. So it's this distortion. And brethren, we have laws today that expressly go against or would articulate, if you will, the doctrine of demons. That would articulate that which is against nature and says, not only is it okay, it's lawful. God says it's an abomination. But that is something that he will teach. And for the last one, doctrine number 7. Satan teaches that you should look out for your own self-interest and that you have the right to everything anyone else has. I know it's kind of long-winded. Basically, Satan teaches envy and self-seeking. But that you should look out only for your own. Again, the Bible's clear. You should be looking out. You should be taking care of yourself. But you got to think beyond that as a Christian. Satan teaches, nah, not so much. Just worry about, you know, old Frankie there and not anybody else. Turn over, if you would, to James. James chapter 3, starting in verse 13. Who is wise and understanding among you? Let him show by good conduct his works are done in the meekness of wisdom. But if you have bitter envy and self-seeking in your hearts, do not boast or lie against the truth. This wisdom, bitter envy and self-seeking, this wisdom, and there is a wisdom to it, does not descend from above, but is earthly, sensual, and demonic. It is a teaching. It is a demonic teaching to say, I should live by bitter envy and self-seeking. Now, again, those words wouldn't be used. Satan's going to craft them much better. Self-actualization is my favorite word these days. You get to live by that at all times. You get to actualize everything you feel you need in your life without any concern. Verse 16, where envy and self-seeking exist, confusion and every evil thing are there. But this wisdom that is from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, willing to yield, full of mercy, good fruits, without partiality and without hypocrisy. Now the fruit of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. Brethren, Satan teaches and has a doctrine that you should look out only for your self-interest and that you actually have a right to everything anybody else happens to have. Again, have you heard this doctrine recently? And these are the questions I ask myself. I asked, have I heard it recently? And have I believed it recently? Have I lived by it? Because we will tend to act that out. There are many other doctrines of Satan that we could glean from the Bible. Just as there is a mystery of godliness concerning Christ, 1 Timothy 3:16, so there is a mystery of iniquity surrounding Satan and his work, 2 Thessalonians 2:7. Satan, being the great counterfeiter, mimics God's doctrines and teaches sweet-sounding alternatives. But brethren, they are the path of death and destruction. We, being the lowest form of sentient beings, we adhere to, we agree with, and we live by one doctrine, set, or the other. We will adhere to Satan's doctrines, or we will adhere to God's doctrines in our life and in our actions. Brother, I want to end with the question I've been asking all along. Satan is actively teaching his doctrines. Are you listening?